did what I did for the good of the realm.
The realm?
Do you know what the realm is? It's the thousand blades of Aegon's enemies. A story we agreed to tell each other over and over till we forget that it's a lie.
But what do we have left once we abandon the lie?
Chaos. A gaping pit waiting to swallow us all.
Chaos isn't a pit. Chaos is a ladder. Many who try to climb it fail and never get to try again. Fall breaks them. And some, given a chance to climb, they refuse. They cling to the realm. Or the gods. Or love. Illusions. Only the ladder is real. The climb is all there is.
White Aryan Resistance Radio. This is Terrible Tommy. Tom Metzger right here in North Central Indiana for a little while. Yeah. Well, it's getting warm back here. It's warming up, I'm telling you. Get my thong out. If I got time, I'll go down to the creek and swim a little. It is February the 17th, 2017. So that's what the date is, and we're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. Our telephone contact number is 559-670-1473. The only thing you can do is climb that ladder. Yeah, that's right. And forget the realm. The realm is almost over. At least in its present setup. The realm is slowly deteriorating and ultimately it will collapse. No matter whether you have a Democrat or a Republican or you have a Hillary or a Donald Trump or whoever. It's going to happen, boys and girls, so get ready. We don't know the hour and the time and the date. But we know the chaos factor is working greatly. So don't play around and screw around and waste your time in the right wing or in the left wing or in the political parties. That's all behind us. All behind us. Several of you subscribers have said how you like the history part of the show, and like the World War II and so forth, and the crimes of the people, the leaders of the time. So I dug out a little pamphlet. This was printed way back in the 30s, or maybe the 40s. I'm not sure when it was printed. I looked here, but its pages are all yellowed and coming apart. It's a wonder I still have it. It's called The Truth About England. When in October 1937, President Roosevelt startled America and the world with his declaration that the democratic nations must unite to suppress the aggressor nations, the declaration was quietly whispered throughout England and France as proof that in due time America would again join the Allies in a new war against Germany. When 4 months later, Secretary Harold Eakes broadcast throughout the British Empire, but not in America, the speech in which he promised in substance that should England again be involved in war, America would come to her, and as we have done in 1917, and Ick's promise was quietly whispered throughout England and France as further proof that in due time America would join in another war to make the world safe for democracy. When 10 months later, Secretary Cordell Hull convened the Pan-American Conference in Lima, Peru, it was quietly whispered in England and France that the purpose of the Lima Conference was not, as Secretary Hull had indicated, a conference to promote commerce between the United States and the 20 nations of Central and South America, but was instead an attempt to destroy the commerce then existing between these 20 nations and the aggressor states, Germany and Italy. So interpreted, the people of England and France regarded the Lima Conference as further evidence that America was aiding the Allies and weakening Germany for the war soon to begin. When a few months later, in his best remembered speech, Mr. Roosevelt declared emphatically that in the present war, the entire resources of America should be pledged to the Allies. His pledge, even when qualified by the phrase short of war, was shouted throughout England and France as proof positive that in due time American troops would fight and die for the Allies, as in 1917. In the light of these events, in view of the further fact that for months past our press and radio, pulpits and platforms have flooded the country with pro-English, pro-war propaganda, it should now be evident to every thoughtful American that for more than 3 years our government has moved steadily and methodically towards another world war. From now on, we may expect an acceleration of war preparations and war propaganda. Again, we will be told that England and America are one people blessed with the same laws, customs, language, and religion. Again, as in 1917, we will be told that our interests are identical, that if England loses, we lose, that as England is fighting our battle, we should join in that battle and fight for England. Because we believe these things in 1917, and because there is some danger that we may believe them a second time, we set forth in this booklet conclusive evidence that such propaganda is wholly untrue. See, England back then was much like Israel today. Israel's our great friend. We love Israel. Israel, we've got to have Israel or we can't make it. Back then it was England. But an England controlled quite a bit by Jews. Since conclusive evidence must be always be found on facts, we submit a suitable foundation. The following historical sketch. Of the 340 years of English-American history, America has been free from the English domination for exactly 40 years. From 1781 and the surrender of Cornwallis at Yorktown to 1891 and the founding of the Bank of the United States, we were free from English domination for a period of 10 years. From 1833, when Andrew Jackson destroyed the Bank of the United States, until 1863, when Congress passed the National Banking Act, we enjoyed another 30 years of freedom from English domination. Thus, our history falls into two divisions, 40 years of economic freedom and 300 years of economic and political servitude to the English kings, Jewish bankers, merchants, and shipowners. Using this 300 years of English domination as a blackboard, we will inscribe in schoolteacher fashion a series of dates and events that will reveal and prove the truth about England. The period of constructive servitude. From about 1600 to about 1750, the American colonies enjoyed a continuing increase in population and prosperity, despite an ever-present and increasingly restraint imposed by the Mother England. In 1606, the English Crown granted the colonies their first charter, under which they permitted to establish a colonial government. And among the grants and privileges set forth in the Charter, the concession of the greatest importance was that contained in the Section 10, which empowered the colonists to establish their own banking system and issue and circulate their own colonial money. because this colonial banking system was free from any English interference and because their money was issued by the government and not by private bankers. The colonies experienced an immediate expansion of commerce, both between the colonies and with foreign nations. As a result of this expansion in trade, the colonies grew in population and prosperity until they were known and envied around the world. By 1750, the American colonies, with a population of nearly 3 million, and with growing commerce, sailing the seven seas, began to be known in Europe as the American Utopia. But in England, the American Utopia with its colonies were growing too fast in population and wealth. In another generation, they would be relatively independent with their own banks, their own industries, and their own commerce. So the English bankers and the manufacturers said to the English crown, "If the American colonies attain economic independence, they will soon demand political independence, and thus the crown will lose its brightest jewel, and we will lose our best market." Thus began between the crown and the bankers and the merchants a conspiracy to prevent American independence, either economic or political. This was similar, but not the same, as the war between the states and the secession. The North was fearful that the South was finally going to build a manufacturing base and that they were going to get rid of slavery. As the first step in the conspiracy, Parliament passed a law forbidding the colonies from trading with any nation except England. The Parliament expecting the law to have three specific results. First, since American ships would no longer call in any ports except those of England, immigration to the colonies from other lands would be greatly restricted, and the population of the colonies remain largely English. This result would benefit the crown. Technically, it would have benefited the racial pool, too. As a second result of the law, the colonies would be compelled to sell their raw materials and farm products to English merchants and be compelled to buy from their manufactured products from English merchants and for such prices as the English merchants would dictate. This result would benefit the merchants and the manufacturers. Third, since the balance of trade would always be in favor of England, and this trade balance must be paid in gold, the colonies have no gold, would be compelled to borrow it from England. This result would benefit the bankers of England. One need not be a financial expert to understand that this first step of the conspiracy would be a terrific blow to the colonies and their expanding commerce, and so it was. In a few years, prosperity had given place to poverty, hardship succeeded happiness, and here and there were men who spoke of revolution. But here, as many times again later, England had overreached herself, for the colonies, unable to buy or sell to advantage in England, began to solve their problem by building their own factories, and by so doing, create a market for the raw materials, create the goods formerly purchased in England, and create employment for their workmen. So, fearing the success of this new threat to their domination, the bankers and merchants of England compelled Parliament to pass a second law, the Stamp Act of 1765. Under the provisions of this law, no circular or pamphlet, no legal documents such as notes, mortgages, and bills of exchange could be circulated in the colonies without first affixing their two English stamps, the stamps ranging in cost from one penny to $50. As in the former case, three results were expected from the Stamp Act. First, it would prevent the colonies from attaining economic independence and so benefit the crown. Second, it would place such a burden on business that investments in colonial industry would be curtailed, and so benefit the merchants and manufacturers of England. Third, since the stamps must be paid for in English money, gold, the colonies would be forced to borrow from English bankers, thus bringing the bankers complete domination of colonial money. But again, as in former case, England had overreached herself, for the act was so completely destroyed colonial business that there was an immediate and almost unanimous demand throughout the colonies for revolution and independence. Aware of this threat of revolution, Parliament repealed the Stamp Act in 1766, but the damage was already done and could not be repaired. For realizing in the two laws just described, England was attempting to throttle the colonies, and realizing further that the colonies' expansion could no longer proceed under English law. The demand for revolution increased in scope and fury until 1776, when the colonies issued the Declaration of Independence and began the war, which ended in victory in 1781 with the surrender of Cornwallis at Yorktown. So ended the 180-year period, which we have called the period of constructive servitude. Constructive because for 180 years, England permitted the development of the colonies, and servitude because that development proceeded under an increased English restraint and was stopped when it threatened to expand into colonial economic independence. Had England possessed that spirit of humanity and democracy of which she has boasted, she would have foreseen the folly of her tyranny. But lacking the spirit, she made the greatest mistake in history, forced America into war, losing all the colonies had become and all they might have become. From 1781 to 1791, the new American state was completely free from English domination. During these 10 years, the Constitution was enacted as the sovereign law of the land. Washington became our first president, and the new nation began its march towards preeminence. But England was not through with us yet. What she had lost at Yorktown, she now planned to gain in New York. What she had lost on the field of battle, she now planned to recover on the field of finance. And so we come to another chapter in English American history, a 120-year period of English tyranny, which we shall call the period of destructive servitude. While this period officially began in 1791, it actually began in 1778. At Valley Forge, in the darkest days of the Revolutionary War, with General Washington unable to procure funds to equip his dwindling army, it looked for a time as though the war for independence would be lost. But at the psychological moment, a Philadelphia merchant, Robert Morris, came to Washington's rescue and placed at his disposal more than $1 million. In these days, $1 million was a stupendous sum, and when the authentic records we discovered that at the time his gift, Robert Morris, was worth approximately $100,000, the question arises, where did he get the millions he gave to Washington? He got it from another Philadelphia merchant, one Haim Solomon the Jew, who in turn had received it from a famous European banker, probably the Rothschild. And it is well to remember in this connection that this $1 million did more than save the revolution. It changed and crystallized the whole trend of American history. An Englishman became our first Secretary of Treasury. Soon after making his gift, Robert Morris suggested to General Washington that he appoint a young man named Alexander Hamilton as aide-de-camp, saying that as a young Hamilton was an expert financier, he would render invaluable services in handling the finances of the army. Hamilton, who had been born British subject and trained in British banking and business methods, soon won the confidence of General Washington, and when 11 years later the general had become the president, he installed young Hamilton as our first Secretary of the Treasury. Hamilton was born down in the Caribbean, I think it was Bermuda or one of those islands. His father was rich, and he was, I believe, adopted, and I believe his father was Jew. It was rumored that the appointment was made on the advice of Robert Morris and Haim Salomon, but he, that is it may, is it is beyond question that Hamilton was better fitted for the office than any other man then available, as his later record revealed. Now you can see here, you know that all through history, the Jews have become quite powerful in England, even worming their way into the monarchy. So there you have that on one side, and then the Rothschild bankers also. And then they wormed their way in over here in the colonies and began to build their power inside the government here in the colonies, in the new country. So you can't win. During his year as Secretary of the Treasury, Hamilton placed the national credit on a sound financial basis, following as far as possible the plans and principles long since adopted by the Treasury Department of the English government. But as later events revealed, Hamilton accomplished something of even greater importance during his years as Secretary of the Treasury. He formed substantial contacts, and friendships with leading members of Congress, who were later to repay his favors in a most substantial manner. After a year in office without a word of warning to President Washington, Hamilton resigned, announced his intention to devote his energies to private business. Since Hamilton had planned the Treasury Department and was the only man in America who understood its intricacies, his sudden resignation participated in the spread throughout the nation, a loss of confidence in government's financial security. Immediately, government finances became involved and the government credit impaired, and when leading bankers and their businessmen announced their loss of confidence, now that Hamilton was no longer in control, a wave of fear and uncertainty engulfed the nation. Beyond question, this is exactly what Hamilton and his friends had planned and expected, to participate in a breakdown of the nation's financial structure as the first steps of a conspiracy to gain control of the nation's banking. About 1 year after his resignation, and with the conditions growing from bad to worse, Hamilton petitioned Congress for a charter for a national bank, urging that no other means could national confidence be restored and the nation's financial structure preserved. When first made, the request was refused, but later, as conditions grew worse, his friends in Congress had done their work. The petition was granted, and Hamilton was given a charter for the Bank of the United States. The said charter to expire in 20 years. Concerning the internal organization of the new bank, the following may prove interesting. In form and power, it was a duplicate of the Bank of England. Much of its stock was bought by English bankers. The gold which sustained its credit had been bought from England. In brief, the original Bank of the United States was little more than a branch of the Bank of England, as Hamilton had planned it should be from the day he took office as Secretary of Treasury, patterned after the Bank of England, financed with English gold and with much of the stock owned in England. The bank began its operations, and how did it operate? It operated as surgeons usually operate, by cutting out something. And in a few years, the bank had cut out the happiness and security of most of the Americans in America. And this is how the bank operated. It restricted its loans to Englishmen who had lately arrived to get in on the ground floor and who at once bought a controlling interest in existing companies, and when this was not possible, started similar companies in competition, too, made loans to their merchants who would make their foreign purchases in England. 3. Made loans to those American Tories of New York and Boston and Philadelphia who had opposed our war for independence. In brief, this Bank of the United States restricted its loans as far as possible to those English and pro-English Americans who could be counted on to aid placing the American people under the financial tyranny of Mother England. As the inevitable result of this concentration of money and control of credit, it was but a few years until this crew of pro-English pirates had captured the American ship of state, together with most of the wealth therein contained. That such a result was inevitable was indicated many years later by Pope Pius XI in his remarkable monograph, 40 Years After, published in 1931. Pope Pius XI said, "This power, concentrated economic domination, becomes particularly irresistible when exercised by those who, because of their hold and control of money, are able to also govern credit and determine its allotment. It was the fact of allotment which made the tyranny of the Hamilton Bank particularly irresistible, for the bank's loans were allotted mainly to the English and pro-English. This system was concentrated money and controlled credit. Hamilton inaugurated it in 1791, a system which in a few years had given a few men complete control of our banking, industry, and commerce. To that end, the Englishmen and the pro-English Americans who had opposed the war for independence received most of the nation's profits, while those who had fought and won the war for independence had been driven out of business and their properties foreclosed." See how that works, boys and girls? It works all the time. No matter what the year is, what the month is, or whatever. Same old ripoff. The credit slavery, debt slavery, wage slavery. In brief, in fact, the other day I heard the Republicans bitching about that evidently the left is asking for a $15 an hour minimum wage. Well, consider how the value of our money has dropped since the 70s. We should have raised the minimum wage a long time ago. So for that, I agree with the other side of the fence. In brief, what England had lost at Yorktown and Saratoga, she had regained in New York and Washington. She had lost the battle with bullets, but won the battle with gold. And again, the American people, as in the days of the colonies, were the victims of English tyranny. True, they still retained their boasted liberties, the freedom of speech and assembly, but these were of no avail, for Hamilton could say with Rothschild, quote, "Give me the power to control a nation's money, and I care not who makes its laws," unquote. But here again, as in 1765, Mother England had overreached herself. Too many Americans had been victimized by her greed. Too many merchants and manufacturers had been driven out of business. Too many farmers had lost their land, and too many workmen had walked the streets. While newly arrived Englishmen possessed their jobs, indeed conditions had grown so desperate that even the congressmen controlled by his Bank of the United States were afraid for their lives and jobs. So it happened that on 1811, when the bank's charter was about to expire, it was certain that Congress would refuse the petition for another 20-year charter. England, fearing the loss of her racket, repeated her trick of 1776 and forced America into war, the War of 1812. Always money behind war, boys and girls. whether it's oil or weapons or whatever it is. Behind all war is primarily profit. The reader is here cautioned to remember that this war of 1812 was a war of aggression, as was the war which later destroyed the Boer Republic in South Africa. True, the war of 1812 may somewhat contradict the English claim that all their wars are fought in defense of democracy and Christianity, but be that as it may, the English won the war of 1812, even though their history books claim they lost it. It was a verification of the old statement that England never won a war or lost a peace, unquote. Thus, after burning Washington and parts of other cities, you know, one thing about that, I think I've said something about this before, the Capitol in Washington didn't burn totally down, because during the night after it was set ablaze, they had a rainstorm in Washington, which put out most of the fire in the Capitol. Andrew Jackson easily defeated the English army under General Pakenham. The case with which America won the war and the nonchalance with which England accepted defeat has long puzzled some students of history. But the explanation is both simple and obvious. England never expected to win the war, her only objective being the objective she really achieved, to bankrupt the American government. As England had foreseen and planned, the cost of the war would bankrupt the government, after which the Bank of the United States would refuse to circulate its money and renew its loans. Then, after a few months of fear and suffering, the people would permit the Congress to issue another 20-year charter to the Bank of the United States, which might as well have been called the Bank of England. The plan worked out accordingly, according to schedule, and in 1812 the new charter was issued, and England and the Bank of the United States were off for another 20 years of plunder. 20 years in which the American people would again be victimized, American merchants again driven out of their business, American farmers again robbed of their land, and again American workmen walked the streets. See, boys and girls, that wasn't the niggers that did that. And it really was, there were handfuls of Jewish big business people involved, but it wasn't a large amount. It was white, Anglo-Saxon Christians screwing their fellow racial people, white people. And all for a group of English stockholders and pro-English bankers masquerading behind the title the Bank of the United States. When after another 20 years of loss and suffering and poverty and foreclosure, the bank, second bank of charter was due to expire, and the bank was prepared to petition for a third charter. Andrew Jackson, who had defeated the English in 1812, decided to defeat them again in 1832, and so in this year he ran for presidency, promising, if elected, that he would destroy the Bank of the United States forever. When elected by tremendous majority, he kept his promise and destroyed the bank, which for 40 years had served as American branch of the Bank of England. As a result, he became and remains the most hated American in English history. He also became the most typical American in American history, but he had not destroyed the bank forever. For in 1872, the bank returned in a new form, but under the same control. Andrew Jackson was one of the greatest presidents of this country. Not only did he fight the bankers, and he fought the British troops, and won the Battle of New Orleans, things like that, but he also opened up the West for massive white European migration, one of the greatest, largest migrations of white people in history. A lot of times you'll hear these Harvard types saying how bad Andrew Jackson was, but he was actually one true American, a real American, who brought the national debt to zero. Most people don't know that. I ask that question all the time. Who brought the national debt to zero? Did any president ever? Only one, Andrew Jackson. And he drove the Mongol Indians got them out of the way, too. Oh, I'm sorry. Native Mongols. That weren't native. In 1872, an agent of the Bank of England, one Ernest Said, S-E-Y-D, who may have been Jewish, I don't know, came to America bringing with him $500,000 in cash. Well, that was like the Warburgs did that too later on. They said he was a poor German immigrant when he came to the country with millions of dollars in his suitcase. The $500,000 which he later used to persuade Congress to demonize silver, of which only the United States and India have the greatest deposits of silver in the world. So the big boys and the Jews and the other people that were opposed to the control in the United States of our own destiny, they did not want us to put us on the silver standard. They wanted to keep us on the gold standard, which would keep countries like especially England in the driver's seat. Now, since the days of Jackson, particularly in the agricultural district, silver had been our chief medium of exchange, and as such had been mainly responsible for the great increase in national wealth which we experienced in that period between 1832 and 1872. During this 40 years, silver had been lawful money, which is to say, good for all debts, both public and private. But after 1872, when a bribed Congress, what's new, demonetized silver, it was no longer lawful money and could not be used to exchange public debts or government bonds. After 1872, government bonds must be redeemed in gold. Gold certificates or national bank notes to workmen and farmers. This demonetizing of the silver made little difference at first, since the few workmen and farmers were redeeming government bonds, but it made a great difference and a great profit to the bankers of England, who held nearly $1 billion in American government bonds, which had been issued by Lincoln to finance the Civil War. After that war, and while our commerce and industry were still disorganized, these bonds fell below par, perhaps were driven below par. And when they struck bottom, they were bought up by these English bankers, and for a reason that will now appear, on the face of these bonds were found the words redeemable in lawful money of the United States, words which would later cause the third greatest panic or depression in our history and set in motion a series of financial reverses from which we have not recovered to this day and probably never will. In brief, when the bonds were issued, they were redeemable in silver, which was a lawful money, but after 1872, the bonds must be redeemed in gold, or silver was no longer lawful money, nor good for public debts. So here's a country that's one of the largest silver sources in the world, the United States and India, that the British cut their feet out from under the Indians and Americans, so they couldn't use silver. So to complete, and you think your leaders are always conspiring against you. Don't you get it? Don't you get that straight? They get into office and get the power for that reason, for most of them, either just for power or power and the money. That's what they do. Once in a while, there's an oddball that wants to play honest, but my enemy, the state, is what the book says, and that's what it is, my enemy, the state. So to complete their conspiracy, the English, who didn't want silver but wanted gold, sent Ernest Said to bribe Congress to demonetize silver after their American bonds must be redeemed in gold or lawful money. He took that $500,000 and spread it around Congress and got what he wanted. Now there were two reasons for this conspiracy. First, they wanted our American gold for its intrinsic value on the world trade. Second, and more important still, they knew that the withdrawal of this gold from America would produce a terrific panic. The panic of 1873, or the depression of 1873. And that is, as a result of this panic, the value of our corporate stocks and bonds would depreciate at least 50%. So they planned that when the effect of the panic had reached bottom, they would return to America and buy our best stocks and bonds in banks, railroads, and industry, and for half of their actual value. Do you get it, boys and girls? Do you get it? I've been preaching it for many decades. Their conspiracy worked out exactly as planned. Silver was demonetized, and the panic did depress stocks and bonds to half their former value, and then the English came back to America to buy our banks, railroads, industries at their own price and buy them with the profits they had made on our gold and on our bonds. And as the English say, it was a bloody profit. And to earn it, they forced upon America one of the most heartbreaking panics or depressions of our history. Following this depression of 1873 came 5 years of intolerable suffering. Bank and business failures, home and farm foreclosures marched across the country like a pestilence until finally, in 1878, with revolution threatening, Congress reversed itself and partially remonetized silver. After 1878, with silver on a partial parity with gold, prosperity began to return, and though interrupted for a time in 1893, that prosperity continued to grow and expand until 1917, when the Pied Piper of London came back again and lured us into his den of luring us into war. During the World War, we loaned to England approximately $7 billion. That'd be about $20 billion now. A loan that was to bring us the greatest panic and depression in our history. A loan that was to prove conclusively that the American bankers and statesmen are Boy Scouts when it compared with the bankers and statesmen of England. They still are. A loan that was to prove conclusively that when we cooperate with England, we're flirting with economic suicide. And here in brief is the record of the result of that loan. In 1923, an agent of the Bank of England came to America and said to President Harding somewhat as follows. Quote, Mr. Harding, in the political campaign of 1920, you and your party promised that if elected, you would collect the war debt owed to America by England. You are aware, as we are, that for months past there has been an increased demand that you keep your promise and collect this debt. You are also aware that behind this demand is a growing threat that if you fail to collect the debt, you and your party will be defeated at the next election. So we are here in England to discuss a plan by which the debt can be paid and you and your party retained in office. You will realize, Mr. Harding, that we... cannot pay you in gold, for most of our gold was sent to America during the war as payment for munitions and war supplies, gold which will still circulate among your people. You will further realize that we cannot pay you in goods, for the reason that our goods would be complete with American products of factory and farm, a policy forbidden by your tariff laws and the abhorrence to the Republican Party. However, we have a plan which, if it meets with your approval, will not only pay our debt to you, but will guarantee a period of great prosperity for all the American people. And here, Mr. Harding, is our plan. If you will permit us to sell to your people $7 billion worth of English and foreign stocks and bonds, we will agree to spend every dollar received from such sale right here in America, and you will quickly realize, Mr. Harding, that putting $7 billion into the veins of the American industry and commerce will at once generate an unequaled era of prosperity. Most of the billions so received we will spend for American products, both factory and farm, and thus carry a continuing wave of prosperity to those who need it most, the working men and farmers. We will spend the remainder so received for factory equipment and machinery, which will be installed in England and throughout the empire. And for this reason, during the war, most of our factories were decimated and became munitions plants, leaving us unable to produce for foreign markets as had been our custom. But with this new machinery purchased from America, we can refurbish our factories, resume production, and thus earn the money which to pay our war debt and to redeem the stocks and bonds we are now proposed to sell in America. President Harding agrees. The plan appealed to Mr. Harding and was later approved by President Coolidge and Mr. Mellon. Mr. Mellon, I think, was the head of the Federal Reserve. And so during the 1923-1924, the English bankers sold in America, and mostly to the people of moderate means, $7 billion worth of English and foreign bank stocks and bonds. It is, of course, a matter of record that most of these stocks are now worthless and most of these bonds are now in default, which is to say that we have not only lost the original war debt of $7 billion, but lost also the $7 billion paid for our worthless stocks and bonds. Now $14 billion is a terrific sum of money, and to lose it is a terrific loss, even to a nation as rich as ours. But this $14 billion is the smallest loss we suffered as a result of our loan to England. The greater loss, approximately $200 billion, came about as follows. And we begin with the question, did England keep her word and her promise to President Harding to spend the $7 billion received for her worthless stocks and bonds here in America? Yes, she did keep her promise, and how? And this is how she did it. She spent $2 billion of our money buying our gold, and for a reason that will later appear, she left the gold on deposit here in America. She then spent $4 billion on our money, buying our gilt-edged stocks and bonds in our biggest corporations. Most such stocks and bonds she took to England and Europe to use as security for further loans there. The remaining $1 billion of our money she spent in buying our latest improved mass production belt line machinery. And here the story gets hot. In taking this machinery to England and her colonies, she took also American engineers and factory foremen to install the machinery and to teach the English workmen how to use it. This task required about 4 years, but finally, when the task was completed, early 1928, the British Empire, for the first time in history, was on a mass production basis, able to produce as rapidly as any nation in the world and far more cheaply. And now see what happens. You see, this you got to go back to Hitler's rise to power. Hitler was always enamored with the British Empire. And, of course, he proved that at when he allowed the...
Call from 1-574-371.
Anyhow, I got disturbed there, but the point is that Hitler was wrong about England, or he was wrong about the leadership, of course. It's totally Jew-controlled, even in the monarchy. The blood is tainted with Jew blood. And he must Well, he should have figured out how rotten they were at the top in the big banks and so forth of Britain. And the best thing he could have done was to take Britain down and then rebuild the infrastructure and maybe have the Queen step down. Or if she played ball, let her remain on the throne as a figurehead like she is now anyhow. At Dunkirk, he let the whole British Expeditionary Army that came in there to fight him in the Low Countries, let him go. The panzers were ready to roll up on him and clean him out or take him prisoners. But Hitler said let him go, which came back to bite him in the ass. He'd have been better off working with Russia than England, to be perfectly honest. Well, boys and girls, that's the end of that part, and we'll continue tomorrow and see if we can get you a little bit more up on this money thing, because if you don't understand the weapon of money that's used against the white race or the best of the white race, because a large percentage of the white race are the ones that are doing it to you, and you're blaming it all on the Jews and the blacks and everybody else, but I'm telling you, the legitimate, honest, best of the white race is being screwed by the other part of the white race. More than you'll know. I'll see you tomorrow.
But I always knew I was doing the right thing. Because you have a steadiness about you. And I believe in you. But it comes soon. And you must be smarter than your enemy. What are you trying to say? The Americans, they're very smart, but sometimes they can be incredibly stupid. They spend all this money and time and energy on the so-called war on terror. They put satellites up in space. They can ram a smart bomb up a camel's ass from a situation room 5,000 miles away. But every time the U.S. kills an Al-Qaeda leader, what happens? There's a new one before the body's cold. You do it a million times, and they never get it because the real solution always eludes them. That is, do nothing.
Nothing.
Nada. If you want to shut down a fundamentally flawed system, all you gotta do is step out of its way, and it'll shut itself down. Nature has a way of correcting itself.